Hello, my friends. Kyle Tierman here, and welcome to another episode of my podcast. Hope you're all having a wonderful day from wherever it is you are listening to my voice. This episode of the show is brought to you by Claude Copywriting Agency. That's right, everybody. I started a copywriting agency, and we don't do everything. We do one thing very well. We write the best goddamn emails your customers will ever read. We work with startups, small businesses, big businesses to craft email flows that will get your customers to laugh, cry, and get tattoos of your brand on their lower back. Claude Copywriting Agency. Some of you guys know that for a few years I worked as senior copywriter at Mudwater. And while there, we learned a lot about how important good email marketing is. So over the past year, I've been developing my own thing. And if you want to get your email flows in order this year, you can go to claude.agency, not .com, just claude.agency, or click the link below and reach out to me directly. My contact is on there, and I would love to work something out. Because the people who listen to this podcast probably have cool ideas, and maybe we can help you get your cool ideas out to your customers in a more elegant way. This podcast has been a long time coming. Cole Christensen is undoubtedly one of the most interesting people in surfing. He's a fellow Patagonia surf ambassador. I've known him for a long time. He's been on the cover of Surfer Magazine. He's won big wave surf contests. He is as legit as it gets. And also just someone who, in a world where we all seem to be flattening down to a singular personality that is acceptable for social media, Cole really seems to be off in the stratosphere somewhere in his own thoughts and originality. A friend once told me, if there was a Hunter S. Thompson of surfing, it would be Cole Christensen. He lives on the North Shore of Oahu. I had the pleasure of sitting down with him a couple days after the Eddie opening ceremony, where he is an invitee, and we had a wide-ranging conversation. He told some crazy-ass big wave stories that I don't doubt have been told anywhere else. We talked about psychedelics, mindfulness, what Cole is currently up to, big wave risk assessment training, of which Cole was very instrumental in starting. If you're interested in getting into big wave surfing, I highly recommend taking a BRAG course. That's BWRAG. It is a course that just teaches preparation and safety so that when we're all out there, we can keep a better eye on each other. And Patagonia has also been very instrumental in supporting these courses and allowing more people to surf big waves safely. So we talk a bit about the beginning of BRAG and where it has gone from then till now. All right, I'm going to stop talking and let Cole start talking because he's got better stories than I do. So without further ado, please give it up for the one and only Cole Christensen.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
Not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
If you get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up.
All right.
Jay, homie.
Ready, set, go.
Good shredding with you.
Cole Christensen in the house.
Thanks. My man.
My man. It's been years in the making. Years in the making. I want to start off by asking you about your story in Chile with Nathan Fletcher, where he got washed into the island.
So that one, you know, Nate brought me to Mavericks for my first time, in 2007, and it was we flew up there. We were surfing Phantoms. This was before I had hooked up with Patagonia or had any sponsors, and we were surfing Phantoms. And Nate's like, "Hey, you want to go to Mavericks tonight? I think it's gonna be good tomorrow." This was, you know, we had been tracking swells a lot, but not like we do now. And so I was just like, sure, yeah, let's go. So we jumped on a red-eye flight. I didn't have a wetsuit, so I borrowed a wetsuit. I think I borrowed it from Jeff Flint was in town, or I don't know who I borrowed it from, but we flew up to on a red-eye flight and with Nate and Hank.
And the Hank Gaskell?
No, Hank Photo.
Hank Photo.
Yeah. And I remember we landed and we went straight to like Red Eye, went straight to just some shitty fucking fast food joint and got a bunch of food. And Nate had to pick up a board from Stretch in Santa Cruz. So we drove down there and Stretch had shaped me my first like kind of big custom 10-6 for up there or whatever. And I picked that board up and he picked his board up and we went down to Anthony Tajnik's house, and he had like this old like Powerlines video on with like this loud music. We're all getting pumped, and it was all foggy, and it's like I think the first time I've been to, you know, really been to Santa Cruz that morning. And we heard it was still super foggy, but it was like 8 in the morning, 9 in the morning by now, and we're watching these videos. And then Tazzy's like, "You know what, I'm not gonna go." We're like, "What?" He's like, "I'm going to go to Ghost Trees." I'm like, "Fuck, oh yeah." So he goes to Ghost Trees. That was the day that Peter Dabby has passed away. And Nate and I at Ghost Trees, and Nate and I and Hank drove up to Mavericks, and we get to the parking lot, and I felt like there was just like, it just was like the weirdest vibe. I've never been there before, and all these guys, I felt like they'd been up all night, and felt like I was looking at a bunch of zombies, and like it was like flea guy, like bunch of guys, and like, I mean, this is back I think when things were a bit looser, and we're like, "Oh fuck," and everyone's like, "Oh, it's too big, it's fucking huge, it's foggy, yeah, no, you guys shouldn't be paddling it." And Nate's like, "No, let's just go over here, we'll just go get one, you know." I'm like, "Yeah, let's go get one, you know, just go out." And I think Pete Mill and Hank, we go out on the, Peter gives us a ride, and we get out there, and I remember Kaylee, Ian, Garrett were towing, and I seen Jamie Mitchell, I think, towing, and it was huge. It was breaking way on the outer reef and like rolling through.
And you had nothing to reference that to, because you had never been to maps.
Zero reference point. It was all fog. I still hadn't seen the shoreline. That whole trip, I never saw the shoreline. My first trip, the Mavericks, never saw what it looked like, and except for one moment when it was like, it was weird. We were just sitting on the skis, kind of watching. We were fine to watch, but we were kind of drifting out and deep and like watching and these huge waves. But there, the cloud, the fog, kind of like the sun, kind of like it was like getting afternoon. And the sun kind of burnt the fog a little, and it kind of lightened up just a little bit, and just had this, the energy change, and it almost just said, "Hey, you know, jump in and paddle out and just sit there." And we did, and we just drifted out. And right as we drifted out, boom, big wide one came. I turned and flipped and went. And
you're paddling. You're paddling.
Yeah, just me and Nate were paddling. Everyone was towing. But everyone had stopped towing to watch us. It was like weird. It was like this, just they took a break. And Nate got one, and then I got one. And I remember like everyone on their skis like giving a standing ovation. And Grant was there.
What was the wave that you got?
Hank's got a photo of it somewhere. It was just a big right.
You make it?
Big glass, yeah. Made it down, and Nate made his, and I might have been caught like down on the last bit or something, but made it through the main part of it. And we were like, "Okay, we're good. That was epic." And then I think they started towing again, and the fog moved back in, and we went in, and we had dinner at Half Moon Bay. I think John was with us, or he got there that day. He was going to surf for the next day with Nate. And then Garrett and Kaylee come in, and they're like, "Hey, let's go to Toto's." I'm like, "Fuck." And there was that guy Malibu Mike in his van. And
so you're gonna drive across California.
So like I'm like, "Really? Okay, that sounds like a fun time." So I jump in with them, and we go by down to Santa Cruz again, and we go by Flea's house, I think, or one of those guys' houses. I think it was, and this was back, you know, and like I remember this chick was like passed out on the floor, there was vomit, and there's everyone's partying. It was just like it was just going off, and we made like a pit stop there and loaded up or whatever, and then got back in the van and headed south. And I remember, like, those guys had passed out, and I remember just driving, watching the sunrise. I've never even been down here, and we're like, I'm headed towards the border. I knew it was, I just had to
go
south.
So you drove all night?
Well, they drove a lot of it, but then they fizzled, and then they're like, I'm like, if we were going to continue, I felt like I needed to jump in and drive. And I ended up making it to the border, and then we got through. And I think they got in a big beef, and we made it out, but we made it out late by the time the onshores were coming on because the harbor wouldn't let us out. But yeah, Greg, yeah, everyone was out there. It was the day of days. And I ended up paddling it, and Garrett and Kaylee, they got in a beef or something, and they didn't even tow. And it was, it was an adventure. And so back to your question, the Nathan to Chile was a like kind of return to favor because he had invited me there, and he'd always been asking about Chile, and this one in particular was massive, and Ramon and the boys had...
Was this after the Maverick story?
Oh, yeah. This is okay. Way later.
Years after.
Yeah, years after.
Because you and Nathan Fletcher travel a lot together.
Yeah, not a ton, but we had done some trips, and this was out... I mean, to put it like in a timeline, this was after Cyan had died because... He had a V1 and I had the Patagonia vest. So the safety protocols had evolved by this point, and we have, you know, maybe they had evolved technically, but not mentally for us in all aspects of our life. So we were,
what do you mean?
Well, give me a second. I'll build up to that part. Okay. Cause we got it. I saw the swell organized with the boys, and I'd been going down to Chile since the 90s, so been tracking swells there, and this one looked big, and Ramon guys are always gracious enough to invite me to join them, and they were going to this new new zone. I'd been to it once before, but this swell looked bigger, and I'm all, Nate, this is a good one, and the boys, like, when they do stuff, they do it right in Chile. They have a lot of resources, and they have the bandwidth to organize and mobilize, you know, whole teams and camp setups. And we had probably 8 jet skis, and we arrived, we flew in and drove up to the zone. We found them, and they had camp set up and jet skis, and we're overlooking this point, overlooking this big left and this big middle peak. I don't know if you remember that shot of Ramon, and they did an ad campaign with him with the windmills in the background.
Yeah.
It was that spot.
Yeah. That so Russo shot?
Yeah, Russo might have shot that, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he did.
Yeah, it's an amazing photo.
Yeah, yeah. And so we got it, and we scored this wave. It was big and fun and gnarly. And we saw one wave that might have been 80 feet. It was just blacked out the whole horizon. It's the middle of the country, and, you know, because of the windmills, it's a very windy area. So it's rare for you to see large swell with... you know,
light
and variable or light winds. And it was one of those moments we scored, and, you know, we were exhausted. And that whole Ramon's team and the Mekis brothers, they were all exhausted because they had brought all the equipment, and they needed to get everything back down to their homes and everything. But because we just flew in, we were like pretty mobile. I'm like, let's chase the swell north. Greg Long was there, I believe. Yeah, he was there. And we're like, okay, let's go to this wave in the north. I was thinking to go to Arica and surf El Bue because I knew, you know, that's a pretty obvious one that gets really good. And this was the size type of swell that it would be maxing on, almost like the time that Fletcher and I went down there, it'd be like that. So I wanted to share that with Nate. You know, it's a mission. So we call, and like by this time it's already dark, you know, and we're like, and we've already had a couple of beers, and we're like, okay, let's go there. We couldn't get a flight. Okay, I was just full for some reason. And then, okay, well, let's back up. Let's go down to Iquique because I spent some time there, and there's this big, crazy slab that we could probably go tow. And there's some other waves, too, that we could check out. And I don't know what was going on. That it was like a weekend, but there was no flight. But then I remembered, I mean, this other guy, I'm not going to tell the town or the place because they like to still kind of whatever. But he had always been inviting me, and he was a Facebook friend of the filmer that was working with us, Sebastian, at the time. And I'm like, Sebastian, hit up that dude. And that guy told us about that place, that island. And he's like, oh, yeah, yeah. So we hit him up, and, like, the guy's all, yeah, come. So we kind of got a green light late at night, and we found some flights to that town at 3 in the morning flight. So we're pretty much like, okay, well, this is going to be a long night. So, yeah. So we went to the airport, and, yeah. And anyway, we got on the flight. I think we got a hotel room for the airport hotel for like a little bit. And we flew up there and we landed, and it's the driest desert in the world, right?
So, yeah. I've been to Iquique.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a town, it's a different town, but it's in that same, it's south of there.
Yeah. There's huge sand dunes leading right up to the ocean.
Yeah. Just beautiful. Yeah. And just, like, you know, totally juxtaposition of where we were coming from.
In the central or southern
central
area.
Where it was beautiful. Yeah. I think it was like, you know, it was all green.
Monterey pine trees. So, yeah. It looks more like Northern California.
Yeah. We weren't that far south. We're kind of in the middle or in between the two, I guess. But it was, we get up there and the guys like pick us up at the airport. They're all psyched. We had an all nighter. We were psyched, you know, we were ready to go and ran on adrenaline and other things. And we get a ride out to the zone, and it's like an hour to where we're going. And we get out there, and I remember we go up the hill, and they were taking us to this one wave, but it looked like huge and like stretched out. And we're like, it looked almost like Jaws looking down on it, like a big right and a left. And then we're like on the top of the hill, and Nate was like taking a shit, and he's looking out to the island, and he comes running back. He's like, bro, I just saw the wave. And we run up there, and we see this big, like 25-foot or huge wave just barreling and spitting off this island. And okay, that's it. We got to go there, right? Because, you know, that's where we got to go. So we go down to the little wharf area, and it's like all these like masonite cardboard, like how it just looked like, it looked like kind of almost like Mad Max feeling in the desert, with all these like little shacks and all these rundown cars and rusted out like old buildings. And
just to set the scene, so it's you and Nate, you guys have one ski?
Me and Nate, no, we had organized two skis. We didn't have any skis this trip. Okay. Yeah, this was the first trip. We went back and we organized.
So you guys are just going to paddle it.
We organized. Going back was a good story too. But we were just going to paddle. Well, yeah, we didn't have any skis. We just had we were trying to get a ponga to go out. I mean, it's far. Like, we're not going to paddle out. Like, we could, but like that would be kind of. I mean, even that would have been a stretch for us in our state. So we decided, okay, let's get a ponga. But we're going around asking all the fishermen, and they're like, no way. There's no fucking way we're taking you out there. You guys are crazy gringos. Like this, you know, that's their livelihood. They don't go fishing on days like this.
Right.
And so we're like trying to convince them. And then we like, you know, we're not making any headway. We drive south to the next fishing village, and we don't get anywhere there. I have this cool picture of this lady walking around in pajamas being followed by like 10 dogs coming out of this little hut. And there's piles of, you know, seaweed and these are like, this is the real deal. Like, we're out in the middle of nowhere, and these are the little fishing villages. And, but at that, right around like mid morning, the fog, cause it was foggy, it was like hazy, and it just felt kind of like you didn't want to go out there. Like, they didn't want to go out there, but the sun popped and it just like opened up. And then it, like, the whole vibe changed again, kind of like back to what happened at Mavericks. And then this one totally toothless fisherman was like, okay, I'll do it. Cause we started increasing the amount of money we were going to offer him. We finally made the deal. And, we motored out there, all of us on this little boat, and we get out to this island, and he's staying well clear of the break, and we could see the big left, but we couldn't really see what was on the inside, cause he's so far out. So we didn't have, you know, in retrospect, there's a lot of things we could have done to manage the risk, but we didn't, and we were just so excited. We finally made it out. So we jumped off the boat, got geared up. We had vests though. Like, we did have inflatable vests. And
you had like a V1 Patagonia.
I had the original and he had the V1 Billabong. I had the OG, one of the prototype Patagonia ones. And he had the one that blew up in the back, but didn't have a, deflate valve. Mm. It's like a big pillow on your back. And we paddle out, and it was beautiful, man. It was like everyone else, the other boys were all scared, the Chile guys. They were like, oh, this is crazy. The fisherman's yelling, you guys are crazy. Don't go. Bro, we got this, man. It's what we do. And like Sebastian's there and Russo's there. And Sebastian, we left Sebastian on the mainland with the long lens, like zoom way in.
He's your filmer.
Yeah. And so it was just me and the guy John Bue and the other Chilean dude, Diego, the banana man. His family imports bananas. And it was just us and Russo and me and Nate. And so we jumped off the boat. Oh, and back to the Greg part. Greg was in the car with us going down. And he was like, we're like, yeah, Greg, let's go. And he looked at me and Nate, looked at his phone a few times, looked at me and Nate. And he's like, no, I'm not going with you guys. And so he went to Pico Alto. Mm. So he flew up and met up with his friends. And they had a great session up there in Pico Alto. But I think he was a little... he could probably see the writing on the wall on this one. Although it would have been nice to have him to help, you know. Anyway, so he would have had fun. But we get out there and the waves were just beautiful. This unsurfed new big wave and the water was blue. And I got one. Nate got one. We were getting waves, you know, and we were starting to push each other a little deeper, feeling it out.
It was big left.
Big left.
Okay.
And then...
Big barreling left?
Yeah, big barreling left. And then me and Nate, although it wasn't as barreling as it was as when he first saw it, I think the tide was rising and the swell was dropping. So when we first saw it, it was just huge round, like spinning tubes. And when we get out there, it was like big. There was some, but there wasn't. It was more almondy, which was fine with us. But we were just stoked, you know. And then we rode a wave together, and then we were like high-fiving and then we go back out and I catch one and then Nate's out the back and then this big set comes and we had been pushing each other a little deeper and then Nate takes off and too deep, almost makes it. And then he had this big like 11-foot board we called the Green Monster and he gets pushed in and I'm watching this happen, you know, and I'm like, okay, he's just going to wash through. But then they're inside between us and the island. There's some like rock pinnacles that you could kind of see, but I didn't realize that where he was going, he got sucked through them. So I saw him get sucked through this rock shelf, over this rock shelf and down into the unknown. And he would disappear. And then all the white water, and I couldn't see because it was too far in. He just got sucked all the way through. And the Pongo was way outside. You know, they didn't want to come close. So I was like, okay. So then he disappeared, and I couldn't get to him. So I paddled out towards the Pongo down the coast a little bit, and the Pongo came into me, and I stood up on the Pongo, and we're looking. And we don't see him. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe he's like in this calmer water right before the island. So we're looking for him, and I'm hoping he's not, you know, passed out, floating face down. That'd be worst case scenario. So now all these like emotions start to run through our heads. We're like tripping, you know, on top of everything, and all of a sudden we see this little tiny black dot start to crawl up out of the water on this like cliff face of this little island, deserted island with a bunch of birds. And he gets to the top of it and he like raises his hand and then falls over or sits down or like, so we know he's alive, no board. We can't get in, you know, obviously cause all the white water and everything. So he like gets up, we like wave to him to walk that way. And he starts walking on the island and we go around the island and meet him on the other side. And he's all covered in blood. He had hit his face on the rocks, but he didn't get knocked out. He said he saw the light. He said he saw like the moment before you die. He started going to all this descriptive, this huge description of what he just went through. He got suplexed and hit the reef and thought he died. And then he saw this light and went to this crazy place. And then all of a sudden he was in this lagoon. And then the island was right there. So in the end, it was all this over a cigarette. yeah, it was classic. So we got lucky. He didn't die. We went to the city that night, and I think we sent it pretty hard. And he flew home the next day, and me and Russo hung out. But that was his. It might have been his first and last trip to Chile. It was a. We might get him back down there one day, but that was a pretty good one.
Fucking A.
Yeah.
And was that before you were involved in starting Bragg?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was that must have been like, or it might have been right about the beginning of it.
Mm.
When it was that's a good question. Because we did have the vest. But it might have been before Bragg really like before it all sunk in on me. Because we did go back, but we had more of a plan.
Mm.
And in Bragg, we teach emergency action plans. And
For people who don't know, will you just give a little background on what Bragg is and how it came to be?
Yeah, for sure. So Bragg, the Big Wave Risk Assessment Group, was born from multiple friends dying in the surf over many years. All of us have had, close friends that have died surfing, and we've been there to see it, and it's been really hard on all of us. But the Scion one was this really the straw that kind of broke the camel's back on we need to do something. We need to start. We need to change the safety culture within the surf community, because it's not in a place where it's allowing, us all to get out there and get involved. And it's not a super safe environment. Honestly, it wasn't his death was in a lot of ways preventable, as were many of them before that. And it's no one's fault. It's just the culture hadn't gotten there yet. And now it's because of, Bragg and other movements, we're trying to create surf responders, I guess you call it. So the skill sets that we teach in our course are, the main one is CPR, knowing how to do CPR, doing CPR refreshments and teaching people to do something. But on a higher level, it's the emergency action planning, looking at a surf break in a location from from 30,000 feet and going, okay, this is what the place looks like. This is what could possibly happen. And these are the scenarios. These are the hazards and these are the risks, and breaking it all down and not just showing up and paddling out like me and Nate did. That was absolutely goes against everything we teach and Bragg. And so it must have been before Bragg then, right? I hope so.
What blueprints have you taken from snow culture?
Yeah, so right around the same time that Scion passed, I had done my first V1 course in Jackson Hole. And it was that, I think, realization that combined with his death and Danilo Couto, who really was the fire behind this, because he was right there with Danilo, and Danilo was with us and Scion was with us and all these swells. This was right around 2010, 11, when Big Wave paddle and surfing and the Big Wave Tour and all that was just firing off, and everyone was pushing each other and safety was evolving and vests were coming out and guys were paddling Jaws, huge cloud break, Nell Scott Reef, all these places. Things were really happening. It was shifting from tow to paddle pretty quickly. And it was toe's not really that cool anymore. Let's see how far we can push paddling. Oh, you can paddle Jaws now. Look, and then all of a sudden, and it all evolved together with the safety equipment and with jet skis as being assistance for the paddling, not for doing the towing. But it was, but the whole thing with the snow was they have these courses, and the snow safety systems have evolved for much longer, all over the world. I mean, people die in avalanches every year, many of them. Unfortunately, some of the most experienced people in the snow die from avalanches.
And it sounds like a similar philosophy, though, of looking at a mountain from a 30,000 foot view and assessing where those potential risks are before just going up and climbing it.
Exactly. And that's kind of what we try and teach in Bragg. And it all came from, you know, the funny story. Well, back to really quickly, I just looked and we kind of realized there was no 2-day, 3-day, 1-day course in surfing where you can get this valuable information. And in the snow world, you could go to any ski town, anytime during the winter, almost every weekend and take one of these courses and like, whoa, what's going on? So we kind of modeled it a bit after that philosophy, I guess, that the risk management that they take from there. But Brian, when we went to Brian Chiolano, he's our guru, he's the guy, you know, it's not us. I was never a professional lifesaver, neither was Danilo and our buddy Liam Wilmont, who also was with us at the beginning, and Mark Healy, and all of us. We didn't grow up lifesavers. We grew up surfers, just, you know, shooting from the hip and paddling out when it was 20 feet at sunset with board shorts. You know, it was a different culture, and we grew up in that culture, but it didn't work because a lot of our friends ended up dying. And I'm glad we started this because since then a lot has changed, and now you go to places like Mavericks or the Outer Reefs, and you'll see everyone wearing vests now or inflatable or impact, you know, have skis, and people know people are watching each other. And that's the biggest difference, I think. People would watch each other before, but I mean, they didn't always have each other's backs, especially with a process like having a jet ski in place or having the photographers with radios watching the guys go down, going, hey, the guy's not coming up, he's inside, can you go get him? And just having that form of communication in the lineup has changed dramatically and thus to save lives since it started. But Brian Chiolano is the guy we went to, and he's the guy, old lifeguarding family, grew up on the beach of Makaha. His dad's Buffalo Chiolano, and they've been saving lives and in this world their whole, that's what they do. They live and breathe it. Mm. And everyone pointed to him and we're like, who should we right. seek as our mentor?
Yeah, and it's evolved a lot since then. I've been fortunate enough to take some of those courses, and it really does get you to see big wave arenas differently and think about risk differently and in a way that I think is super healthy for the culture. So you mentioned in the Chile trip, that was far from your first trip down to Chile. And if I am recalling correctly, you went down to Chile very early on to do archaeology. Is that right?
So yeah, it was kind of a...
So what drew you down there? And really tell me that story.
Okay. 1995, I graduated from Punahou High School here in Hawaii. And I was the one kid that didn't go to college out of my class of nearly 400. And it
was Punahou, is that a public school or a private school?
Punahou is a private school. It's kind of like the... it's the oldest private school on the islands. And it's pretty well respected. Jerry Lopez went there. Obama went there. We got Mark Cunningham. We got Dave Wassel went there for a bit. We have there's a lot of surf history. Fred Hemmings, Fred Van Dyke. Back there, I could go on and on. But there's a huge surf culture that went to Punahou. And then, it's a great private school in town. And it's a kind of a college preparatory school. I mean, everyone is expected to go to college. But I met a girl in my class that her dad lived on Rapa Nui and was an anthropologist. And so,
what's Rapa Nui?
Rapa Nui is Easter Island, the one with all the statues, the most isolated inhabited place in the world. It's the southeastern corner of the Polynesian Triangle. It's a five-hour flight off of Chile, Santiago. It was annexed by Chile in 1888. So it's under Chilean rule, but they live independently and speak their own language. They speak Spanish as their second language, but they speak Polynesian language, Rapa Nui, as their first language. And so I was like, okay, well, this sounds cool. Maybe there's a creative way for me not to go to college, but go down there and maybe get college credit somehow. And so I you know, I kind of made this plan. I bought this ticket that went Circle Pacific ticket. It took me to Tahiti, Rapa Nui, Chile, Mexico, LA, Hawaii for $1,600. My parents were like, cool, is that what you want to do? Go for it. And I didn't know how long I was going to be gone, but I had a plan to go there for a few months or a couple months or whatever and make my way home. And I get to Tahiti, love that. Got to go to the end of the road in the late 90s and surf down there. No one was around, met some friends and got my flight to Rapa Nui. And I was going to stay there for, you know, like I said, a few weeks to a few months maybe, but I ended up staying almost 9 months.
On Rapa Nui.
Yeah, fell in love countless times.
Fall in love with it?
Well, I was talking about the girls.
I fell in love multiple times. The
girl. Yeah, yeah.
How many people live on Rapa Nui?
Population back then was, I think, between 5,000 and 6,000. And I don't know if you're in a rapamycin, like that that drug they're touting to be the fountain of youth.
No, I haven't heard about this.
Anyway, there's this crater that's the only place in the world that they found it. And we used to go to that crater with these families, and they'd all bathe in it and do mud baths.
Yeah.
And I didn't really connect it later until I heard about this last couple of years. But anyway, back to the story. It was, it was cool. I was 18. I was the only kind of gringo, whatever, guy on the island, like foreigner, white guy. And I surfed. I traded a surfboard for a horse. I moved in with, moved out of the dude's house. And I did. I read every book on the colonization of Polynesia. I started to do some work with him. And it was rad. I got to, I did learn a lot. And, my focus shifted to surfing and hanging with the boys. And I moved out of the dude's place and moved in with this, other family, the Pakarati family. And, we would just party and surf and go camping. The rules were a bit looser back then in the 90s. You could go out to these, archaeological sites, the quarries where they'd make their moai, and we'd set up tents in the area and camp and fish and dive and set fires. Like now it's all roped off and stuff, you know, but it was pretty loose. We'd go out on horseback and we'd have girls and yeah, it was some, and that was my journey to Chile. So they speak Rapa Nui, but they also speak Spanish, and I'd taken some years of Spanish in high school. And so their Spanish is a bit slower, so it was easier to comprehend. And so I was getting pretty good. And then I meet these girls flying out from Chile, and I wouldn't understand anything they said because they would speak so fast. And but I met some guys. I met a family from the north of Chile, from Iquique, and the son showed me a picture. This was before phones, you know, a little Polaroid or whatever, a picture. And he's like, oh, these are the waves in the north of Chile, and El Colegio on the right. So you got to see this. So long story short, I know we're on a limit here. But he's like,
no, this is great.
You gotta come to the north of Chile when you can. I'm like, fine, that sounds epic. So I talked to one of the my buddy that I was staying with, Pichi Pacarati, who now lives in Portillo in Chile. He's been there for the last like 20 years. But he, let's go to Machu Picchu, man. Like that'd be sick, right? And he's like, yeah, let's go. So I leave before him after almost 7, 8, 9 months. I can't remember how long. They're all, where do you want it? I'm like, want what? Your tattoo, when I was leaving. So they gave me a tattoo. Only tattoo I have to this day, but they did it the old style way. And they gave me this cool tattoo that's a petroglyph on the rocks. So, but anyway, so I get to Santiago.
I'm going to stop you real quick.
Yeah.
Did you ever try the drug that they're talking about that comes from Rapa Nui? And what is that drug?
Oh, we got to do more. It's you don't try it. It's just in the mud, in the water.
Oh.
Because now they make it or they
sell it.
They sell it.
Okay.
But let's do some more research on it. I don't want to misspeak here. Rapamycin.
Rapamycin.
Yeah.
Okay.
And my wife was actually the one just telling me about it. She's a doctor and she's like, hey, have you heard of this rapamycin? Did you see that when you were down there?
Mm-hmm.
And this was just like this year.
She was
asking me about it. And then I was with these like kind of gnarly doctors like this last week, these guys that are really in like homeopathic, like, and they were asking me about it too.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's come back up. So I got to do a little bit of research, but I do remember the source of where it comes from. And I do remember us as like family going there on the weekends. We all hike down into this crater and get in this muddy water and hang out. And I wonder if it's just something that I wonder. Yeah. I wonder, it makes me wonder like why right. they do that or if they know.
Sure.
You know, so I do need to dig in a bit there.
Okay.
But
so you're 18 years old. You've just spent 9 months on Rapa Nui. You're surfing around there. I'm guessing alone most of the time.
Most of the time. I had a couple friends. It's pretty heavy reef breaks. But we had some crazy sessions and crazy stories. We don't have enough time to get into all of them here. But
then you went.
But moving on to Chile, I'll tell that part because that's pretty fun. So I get to Chile, take a 24-hour bus ride up to Iquique. And I get there and I meet some, like, stay in this little surf hostel called Tia Charos. And, you know, it's like $5 a night. And, you know, I'm a dirtbag traveling guy. I have no money. And the waves are just phenomenal. I meet up with that kid that told me to go up there, Benjamin Barros. And we surf. And then Peachy shows up like 2 weeks later. Mm. And we surf. And then we head up and we go. We bus up through Bolivia. And then out to Peru, Machu Picchu, and do like 3 weeks trip, me and him up to Machu Picchu. And I've been there three times since. We did the Camino Inca. Mm. And I have an old picture I'll show you on my phone of me and Picchu on the top of Machu Picchu. Mm. But yeah, so I get back to Iquique, and in this little surf hostel we're staying in is this dude from the south of Chile named Namich, Daniel James. And he shows me this picture. Another picture. At this time, it says this empty, perfect left-hand point break, Portecillo, which has now been developed with houses and everything. Back then, we used to have to go by mule. You go down
the Cuchillo. Yeah, I've been there.
So we're like, but I'm out of money. I'm like a year into this trip, and we're like, oh man, I'm tapped out. I gotta go home and work. So. And that kicked it off, and I went home, worked, and went back. And I've been back, I think, almost every year since, at least once a year, apart from like the 2 years of COVID and my injury to Chile. So it's been a big part of my life and my surfing life and the culture. And it's been fun to grow up part of that. I speak Chilean Spanish, and I've been friends with Ramon since the beginning.
You're pulling out your phone to see a photo.
I got to show you this photo just because I thought of it. But it's a picture of me and Peachy on the top of Machu Picchu when I was 18. And
oh shit, young Cole looking like a GQ model, shirtless above the clouds.
The fishhook.
When you went to Peru, did you try ayahuasca?
On that trip, I didn't.
Have you tried ayahuasca?
Yeah, and I've tried some other things up there.
What's your take on ayahuasca and psychedelics generally?
Oh, I think it's, you know, a mandatory experience if you want to, really connect with yourself and the your surroundings. I kind of look at it like driving in driving down a dirt road that is rutted out, and your tires kind of get stuck in those ruts, and that's our normal life, and psychedelics break down those ruts and allow you to move over that road, and it just opens up the whole playing field. It gets you out of this one way of thinking and this perception. I look at life like there's perception, and then there's reaction to your perception, and then that's where we can connect. And there's varying levels of connection, but it starts with our perception. And our perception is we're molded by, you know, our upbringings, our parents, our surroundings, whatever. And that's different for everyone. I mean, you and me can look at an object and view it completely differently. And we do often, but it's our reaction to that object or experience. And then that kind of forms the connection. And maybe within that, I can connect with you to that experience. Mm. But psychedelics themselves allow, you know, if they're not abused, I've done, you know, quite a bit of psychedelics, and different ones, and there's definitely been times in my life where I did it more for the joyful experience with the friends, like, let's go do this. This sounds epic. And go, you know, whether it's go shred or go to a party or, but, even those moments can be fun, but I think they're really can be more valuable than that. There's a big value add to doing it with, in a really cool setting with, not necessarily an objective, but just an open mind. In a safe place and just see what happens. If no negativity and no preconceptions of what may or may not happen, and then not having any hopes or any expectations, just letting it flow. And you know, it's scary for a lot of people because there are stories and that comes back to our perception, like, oh, so-and-so had a bad trip, and then, oh, this guy, he was never the same. So, you know, I think those stories can scare people.
Mm-hmm.
And now what's really cool is that I have friends, and it's really emerging, and there's a whole new space of psychedelic therapy with not only psychedelics, but, I mean, you can do it with ketamine and
MDMA.
MDMA.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I've had Rick Doblin on this podcast, who's the founder of MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And the FDA is, you know, fast tracking MDMA assisted therapy as a breakthrough for soldiers with post traumatic stress disorder. So I think it's the conversation is very much shifting into one that's more nuanced and less dogmatic. And also, I think they should be taken seriously and they can be really terrifying and make you feel like your consciousness has been unmoored if you don't go into it with the right setting and the right mindset and integrate it properly. Who introduced you to psychedelics and have there, can you think of one that has directed your life in any kind, any psychedelic experience that has directed or redirected your life in any kind of way?
I think it just started, you know, as a young kid, behind our house, there was mushrooms growing in cow patties, and that kind of opened the door. And then there was weed, and, you know, we had all these things, but mushrooms were pretty accessible for us. And the older kids were taking them, and it was more just, oh, this is cool, you know? And it wasn't until, yeah, there was no real guided experience. It was me and my friends experimenting.
Have you used psychedelics in any kind of way that you feel have helped you get through trauma or get through any kind of unhealthy mental thought loops?
Yeah, I think, honestly, personally, I've done enough of them where the road has been pretty rutless. It's a pretty flat playing field. I've been able to drive all over it. Just fucking rodeo. I've had trauma in my life, but, you know, there's people that have a lot worse trauma. I've gone through some injuries. I've gone through some deaths, and I really feel like the psychedelics have allowed me to react differently, and combined with my daily meditation practice, which has really become an integral part of my well-being and ability to react, because I'm not doing psychedelics every day.
But you can meditate every day.
But I can meditate every day, and I can stretch, and I can have some alone quiet time in the mornings before the kids get up and the world gets going. And you know, my practice has evolved over the years and is different, whatever. But at the same time, I think it comes back to what we talked about earlier, how you react to things. Like, everyone's going to perceive something one way and then react to it. And there's these life hacks. There's these things that people have been doing for thousands of years. I haven't come up with, it's not my thing. We've learned things from other people, like the Vedic tradition, like that's been around thousands of years. People have been meditating and breathing and breath work, our life force, like, you know, like We can talk about breath for hours. Yeah. We can talk
What does your meditation practice look like?
Today. Today was just some light asanas and some stretching and just to kind of like wake up. I usually wake up early and then I'll brush my, I make the, Rip Zinger taught me a little life hack. Boil the water and make the tea the night before and put it in a hydro flask. So in the morning, it's the perfect temperature.
Mm.
And you don't have to fuck around with it in the morning. It's, and I've been doing, I think I've done it for over 1,000 days straight now that since he taught it to me. It's ingenious, really. But little things in life that we just learn along the road. And so I make that the night before. I have my tea, and then I stretch a bit, and then I'll sit down. Since my injury, I had a bad injury up Pipeline and bonked my head pretty good. And people said, you could go into depression. These concussions can be gnarly. They can really affect your mental health. Yeah. And
for people who don't know, will you give a bit more of a background on what that story was at Pipe?
Yeah, New Year's Eve 2019, pulled into a barrel, went over the falls and went straight to the bottom, came up. I think the board hit me as well. I got like double whacked. My buddy Andrew LaGreco came in on the jet ski. I was floating face down, wearing an impact vest, so I was floating, thank God. He jumps off the jet ski, grabs me, lifts my head out of the water, yells my name. I take a breath before the next wave hits me. Kai Borg was on the ski, comes in and drags us in. The lifeguards were on duty, grabbed me. It was mid-morning. Next thing I remember, I look, open my eyes, and I have an oxygen mask on, and the lifeguards are, look like angels all standing around me, and I swear I saw Nathan Fletcher walk by, and it was a long ambulance ride to Queens, puking the whole way, 7 days in the ICU after they cut my brain, my skull open, and pieced it back together with plates. And then 3 months before I really got in the water and surfed again. It was one of those, it was as close as it kind of gets, you know?
Mm.
So being part of Bragg and helping create this new kind of safety culture, I've been part of the life saving process and helping teach that, but I hadn't ever been on the extreme opposite side of that. So to be on that side was really powerful, and it's deepened my whole connection with Bragg in many ways. And I know we're segueing here, but I want to tell you about my return to Pipeline the following year. And, it took some courage to get back out there after, hitting your head and almost dying. And I finally get out there. I'm sitting on the second reef. It was another big day, the days I like. I get out to the outside. I see Kalani Chapman, who also was resuscitated at Pipeline. And he's outside, and we're catching up. We, hug each other. And I didn't see him since the incident. He was the last person I was talking to before I got injured. And then I hear all this whistling. I'm not out for 20 minutes. I hear this whistling, and freaking Mikey Red hit his head. So we paddle in. I go walk up the beach, and a bunch of people standing around him, a bunch of lifeguards doing compressions on him. And it just felt like this out-of-body experience, deja vu. Like, I just got here, man. Really? And that was my It took me another year to get back out there. And I get out there, and
so you went in that day.
And I drove down to that place we surfed at one day years ago, and I surfed out there with a couple friends and just washed it off. Started to question things, what am I doing, man? So I get back out there last year, and I paddle out to the second reef, and I just get out there, and it's sunset time. I'm looking out to the horizon. I see Andrew LaGreco, the guy that saved me, and I see him silhouetted, and he kind of waves to me, and I see him. Oh, it's Andrew. So I wave back, and as he waves, he stretches his arm out, and this wave that was too deep for him stretches all the way over to where I was and just allowed me the perfect takeoff, drop in, just so easy, pull up in, and just get spit out of the barrel. And that was my real return. It felt so good. That's the last time I've been out there.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was like a gift from him after all that. And we surfed together We surfed together, this Jocko Swell, this last, when I told you to come down.
Yeah.
And we had back-to-back tubes. I got tubed, I kicked out, and he got the wave behind me, he got tubed, and we like high-fived and hugged in the channel. So we've had this really cool connection, because he saved my life, and that, you know, there's some, definitely deepens,
really, the connection. Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
So that, so the last wave you got at Pipe was a good one.
Yeah, it was. It was a good one. How, Russo was there in the channel to get the shot. It was sick.
How much do you think about getting a good last wave when you're surfing big waves?
I don't anymore. It used to be a priority. Nowadays, it's I think this has come with my injury and my age, but it's two more, skip the last. If I get one, I get one. If I don't, I don't.
Mm. What do you mean two more, skip the last?
In skiing, there's a saying, you never want to say last. Last run.
Bad luck.
So two more. Skip the last.
I like that. Oh, that's good. I like that. And how do you feel meditation or any other modalities, enhanced or otherwise, have helped you recover from that injury?
Yeah, you know, I think...
Because you said people were telling you should expect depression, you should expect maybe a kind of a sorted up and down recovery process.
I think, you know, looking at it right now, today, connecting with your physical and mental being in a quiet space on a daily basis allows you to check in. So you go through these, like, I do a pretty similar stretching sequence. During COVID, I did a yoga teacher training because I was around. I also did a just kind of dive in a little bit in that sector. Like my mom's a hippie. She grew up and she lived in Haight-Ashbury in the 60s next door to Jefferson Airplane and all these things. So she was very into like that. She was into yoga and into all these things. So I grew up around it and meditation, but I didn't connect with it until after my accident, honestly, because it was then that I started reading all these books that she had laying around. And I did, we did this retreat with Deepak. My wife had signed up for it on the Big Island and we flew over there and she was breastfeeding. So, you know what? I can't do this. Can you just do it? And we're there because she was too busy and it was a week long meditation retreat. And I did it, and I thought, you know, I thought it was pretty cool. There were some powerful moments within that. The demographic was definitely different. It was mainly like middle-aged women,
cool.
And then me, middle-aged, with trauma, with past, you know, looking for something. I did a similar retreat with Eckhart Tolle, like a week-long thing with him, and that was a little more diverse, but. After doing the one with Eckhart, you know, they have a pretty commercial operation, but Eckhart's incredible. I mean, but they're both incredible, but, Deepak's incredible. And like they take from all the Vedic traditions and create this really cool retreat and allow you to really connect with the people there and him and everyone. But they're all, since you've taken the retreat, you can do our primordial sound meditation instructor thing for this much more. And I'm like, oh, okay, whatever. So I did it, and I went through their whole course, and I just got to see a whole nother area of teachings, I guess. I just, you never stop learning, right? So I've taken things from everyone I've learned in life, and I think we all evolve and adapt to our own practice. We adapt and it can change and being able to become fluid and not be stuck in any one thing. I think that's the most important. So I'm not stuck on a time. I'm not stuck on a sequence. I'm not stuck on a sequence of breath work or meditation. I let it flow. It's all pretty similar right now today, but back to your question, I think the important part is just connecting and slowing down for long enough to feel what's happening inside of your body physically and mentally, and doing that just by, I mean, it could be as simple as just taking 10 deep breaths, one deep breath, really. I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's just taking that little bit of time every day. And, you know, there's a million ways to do it. And nobody's an expert because everybody's different. But you can take 100 different courses and create your own practice and create something that works for you. And that's what's helped me get through my injury. That's what's helped me get through a lot of things in life. Just checking in and doing that on a daily basis, not just once a week. Because then you have a guide, then you have like a benchmark. Okay, today, whoa, what's going on today? My body's doing this, or my mind's doing this. So if you're doing it every day, you really start to, I think that from my big takeaway is just, it just needs to happen every day for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It changes your brain in a very substantial and helpful way. I use the Waking Up app with Sam Harris and do 20 minutes just about every day. I'm a big fan of it. They have a lot of philosophy in that app that have helped me think about my life and trajectory and where I'm going and where I'm putting my energy and attention in a really useful way. It sounds like you've always been a reader for how kind of far-flung and chaotic your life can seem from the outside. It seems like you've always had a discipline of being in pursuit of knowledge and doing so in a disciplined way. Is there a book that you can think of that really impacted your life in a big way?
Oh, man. So I'm a real historical fiction buff. I love Khan Ugedin and I love Mishner, James Clavell, Leon Uris. So there's these, I love how those guys really can wrap up stories of our past into a digestible, fun way. And I love learning history that way. So like Khan Ugedin does the Julius Caesar series, and then, you know, James Clavell did from Gaijin all the way to, I think the last one was Whirlwind and the overthrow of the Shah in the 70s in Iran. So, but he ties it all together. Mishner is insane. Mishner is like another level. Some of them are a little hard to get through, but some are really good. I just finished Poland just because of what's going on over there. I wanted a little bit of history.
If you could recommend a starter for people listening, what would be the one book in any of those series?
Ooh, in any of those series? I think Leon Uris's Trinity was a great one. That really, really was powerful.
What's that about?
That one takes place in Ireland.
Leon Uris's Trinity.
Leon Uris, but I want to recommend so many. But, James Mishner Poland, that's a pretty relevant. I mean, that's
James Mishner Poland.
I mean, it's a serious read.
Yeah.
But, Taipan by James Clavell is a great one. And that's a fun one. And then the Julius Caesar series by Khan Ugedin. But back to your question, like if there's one book right now that I would recommend Eckhart Tolle's, The New Earth. And I would recommend, I'll talk about the other one will come to me in a second, but so Eckhart Tolle's The New Earth it's an easy read because it's the short digestible little chapters, not even chapters, they're like 2-3 pages, and I'll sometimes read like a little bit of it every day after maybe a meditation. I don't know if you're familiar with Eckhart, but he's
I've read that. It's a good one.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Good one to change your...
A Life and Our Planet by David Attenborough.
A Life and Our Planet.
A Life on Our Planet by David Attenborough is the his witness statement. He's the dude that did all the BBC shows on the planet. So he wrote this book I think it was last year or the year before, on he basically calls it his witness statement, and he says where we have to be if we're going to survive as a species on this planet, and what we have to do. It's insane. You should read it.
Okay.
Yeah, a life on our planet.
All right, people, you might get some text or you might get some Instagram messages from people who want more books.
Yeah, we won't dive too much. Sorry.
No, that's great. All right, second to last question. Skip the last one. What's if your life is in a movie, Hollywood movie? What's the arc of Cole Christensen? How's the story go?
Oh shit, we're living it. I mean, this chapter now is, there's been so many fun chapters, and like a book, you know, we have, I don't know how many more chapters there are going to be, but I can tell you this one right now, if my kids is one of the highlights. I have a 4 and 6 year old girl, 2 girls, and I love it. It's just the funnest thing ever. Having them at the Eddie ceremony on Friday, and they both are in the immersion schools, so they speak Olelo Hawaii, and now my wife also speaks Olelo Hawaii. So I see the writing on the wall here. If I don't learn how to speak Olelo Hawaii, I'm gonna be on the other side of a bunch of shit talking here pretty soon. So at least I want to understand what they're saying. So it's been a fun new journey for me, diving into, I did 2 courses at the community college, and now I'm doing online courses, and I'm actually really, really diving in. So maybe if we check back in a few years, I should be pretty proficient.
That's the next chapter. Hopefully there's many chapters to go. You are a true original, Cole Christensen. And I'm happy I was finally able to sit you down behind the mic, because you have endless stories from a very adventurous life.
I brought you a gift.
Oh, yeah? What do we got here?
Well, here's I got you a couple stickers.
Surf slowly. I got a surf slowly sticker. That's good for me.
So like the seals say, slow is smooth, smooth is fast. So just reminded me to take a breath and slow it down. And then there's this place I surf a lot. Anyway, it's related to this. But change is life. So here's another sticker.
I love it. Got to wrap these around some coffee mugs. And then we got the deep water surf.
And you got the deep water surf stickers.
Cool. And where can people reach out to you if they love this podcast and want to say hello?
Yeah, you can just send me a message on, I mean, the only one I have, I don't have the app right now on my phone, because sometimes I get sucked into it, but in the Instagram app or deepwatersurf@gmail.com.
All right, buddy. It was such a pleasure.
Yeah, bud.
Big fan of what you do.
A fan of what you do too, homie. Keep it up.
See you soon.
Aloha.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you, lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.